Syrian President Bashar Assad made his first state TV appearance yesterday after a bomb killed three in his inner circle, but some are questioning the photo's authenticity. As the violence intensifies, tens of thousands of Syrians are crossing into Lebanon and Jordan, according to reports. We'll discuss media coverage with Michael Peel, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He's reporting from Damascus. And on the domestic front, we'll discuss coverage of voter ID laws and voter suppression with Colorline's Brenton Mock and independent journalist Brad Friedman. We will also talk about coverage of the horrific shootings in Colorado. Join us after the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. President Obama has cancelled events in his election campaign because of a mass killing in the state of Colorado. Mr. Obama said he was shocked and saddened by the shooting to death of 12 people in a Denver cinema and the wounding of at least 50 others. Mr. Obama said it was a day for prayer and reflection, not politics.
We're still gathering all the facts about what happened in Aurora, but what we do know is that the police have one suspect in custody, and the federal government stands ready to do whatever is necessary to bring whoever is responsible for this heinous crime to justice.
A man called James Holmes was arrested near the scene carrying firearms. His apartment in Denver is reported to be booby-trapped with sophisticated explosives. Thousands of Syrians are fleeing the fighting in Damascus, where anti-government rebels are trying to topple the government of President Assad. As many as 30,000 Syrians are reported to have crossed into neighbouring Lebanon, but the United Nations Refugee Agency puts the figure at some 8,500 only. Lise Doucette is at the Lebanon-Syria border.
I met one extended family, seven adults and five children on foot, dragging bulky suitcases. We had to leave, an anxious mother told me. The children were very scared of loud explosions and shooting. We were like prisoners in our home, not knowing who to trust, the Free Syrian Army or the government. One of her young sons then said in quiet voice, I couldn't play in our garden, and the floor of our house was shaking. Then a black pickup truck arrived and the family cheered. They were going to their grandfather's home here in Lebanon. For how long, I asked. We can't go on living like this, the woman said.
A former International Monetary Fund official says he is ashamed to have had any association with the agency. Peter Doyle has left the IMF after 20 years. He set out his concerns in a letter to the fund's senior executive director, which has been published by the broadcaster CNN. Here's Andrew Walker.
Mr. Doyle's letter is brief but excoriating. He refers to incompetence ahead of the global and euro area financial crises. He says timely, sustained warnings were of the essence. Not issuing them is a failing of the first order, he says. Mr. Doyle describes the IMF's managing director, Christine Lagarde, as tainted. Neither her gender, integrity or elan can make up for the illegitimacy of the selection process. That's a reference to a system which has so far ensured that a European always heads the IMF, while an American runs the World Bank.
Eurozone finance ministers have formally approved an agreement to lend Spain up to $120 billion to prop up its banking sector. Meanwhile, the heavily indebted Spanish region of Valencia has become the first to ask the government in Madrid for financial support from a public fund set up last week. World News from the BBC. The head of the privatisation agency in Greece, Kostas Mitropoulos, has resigned, citing a lack of support from the government. In his resignation letter to the finance ministry, Mr. Mitropoulos said the government had systematically undermined his agency's credibility with potential investors. He said without unreserved support, it was impossible to carry out the privatisation programme demanded by the European Union and the International Monetary Fund as part of Greece's bailout deal. The International Court of Justice in The Hague has ruled that the former Chadian president, Issen Abre, must stand trial in Senegal. Anna Holligan was in court.
The judges found that Senegal had breached their obligations under the Torture Convention when they failed to take action against Hissène Habré. The court ruled that Senegal must proceed with the prosecution without further delay if they fail to extradite him to Belgium. The former dictator has been living as a free man in Senegal since he was deposed and fled Chad 20 years ago. Now he must face trial for the alleged killings and torture of tens of thousands of opponents during his time in power.
European Union diplomats say they expect restrictions on development aid to Zimbabwe to be lifted soon. They were speaking ahead of a meeting of EU foreign ministers, which is expected to vote in favour of allowing the EU to deliver aid directly to the Zimbabwe government. Under current sanctions, aid money has to be directed through non-governmental organisations. A court in Scotland has convicted a man of helping to fund a suicide bomb attack in Sweden. Nasruddin Meni was found guilty of financing terrorism. He's an Algerian who's been seeking asylum in Scotland. The court heard he sent thousands of dollars to a Swedish man who blew himself up in the centre of Stockholm 2 years ago. The attack injured only two people because some of the devices used failed to go off. Mr. Meni will be sentenced at a later date. BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The situation in Syria is becoming incredibly tense. On Wednesday, a bomb attack killed three top Syrian officials. Syrian President Bashar Assad made his first state TV appearance yesterday, but many media outlets are questioning the photo's authenticity. According to reports, Syrian rebels seized control of critical border crossings as tens of thousands of people are fleeing to neighboring Lebanon and Jordan. Joining us to talk about coverage is Michael Peel, Middle East correspondent with the Financial Times. He is currently reporting from Damascus. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show. Oh, we're actually trying to connect with Michael. We'll have him in just a minute. And on the domestic front, we are talking about media coverage of voter ID laws and voter suppression. According to a new study from the Brennan Center for Justice, new laws in 10 states requiring voters to show photo ID will make it more difficult for millions of Americans to cast ballots and will likely drive down turnout among minorities, the poor, and the elderly. Joining us to talk about coverage of this is Brad Friedman. He's a journalist and radio broadcaster. He blogs at thebradblog.com. In addition to covering voter ID laws, he's been covering a case in Southern California in which officials admitted to tampering with mail-in ballots. It happened in Cudahy, a small city near L.A. Top city officials agreed to plead guilty to federal charges of bribery and extortion. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And we are in the process of connecting with Michael Peel, who's in Damascus, and hopefully we'll have him in a couple minutes. So, Brad, as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, actually, given the events this morning in Aurora, Colorado, I'm going to change what I had planned to talk about here. I was going to give some credit to the mainstream media, believe it or not, for finally, tying together the heat waves, the droughts, the fires, and everything else going on across the country, the storms, to global warming for the first time in, I think, ever. That's where I was going to go. But instead, I'm going to give a hat tip today to the readers at Reddit, which is an aggregator site. They have this morning been doing some pretty impressive crowdsourcing, putting together a timeline of what happened at the shooting last night in Aurora, Colorado, pulling details from all over the web and actually very good ones, reliable information that seems to be coming in from the crowd, from the people out there on the web. And I think that on a day like today, particularly for folks like me on the West Coast who are sort of waking up and trying to catch up with what has been going on overnight, this has been an incredibly useful resource. So I want to give credit to the Redditors out there for scouring the web, scouring the information that's available out there, scouring the TV, the tweets, and everything else, and pulling together a really comprehensive and useful timeline. And it continues to go at this hour. a very useful timeline of what happened last night in Aurora, Colorado.
Well, and I'm glad you brought this up because I did not want to ignore this today. I mean, it was a horrific shooting, just to bring people up to date. It happened at the midnight screening of Batman in Aurora, Colorado, which is a suburb of Denver. And I wanted to ask you just about how these horrific shootings are covered. It's very formulaic, it seems. Mm-hmm. First of all, they say, was he a terrorist? No, he is a white American, so therefore he's not a terrorist. And then they try to find out if he was a member of the military. According to reports, he was not. Mm-hmm. And then they tend to talk to family members and neighbors, and then they try to find some sort of motive. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I mean, it becomes very formulaic. What are your thoughts about how this is covered and how it should be covered?
Well, you're right. I mean, it is covered. You presented a very nice template for exactly how it does seem to occur. And there's a bunch of hand-wringing and perhaps some navel-gazing that goes on. A whisper here and there of some sort of reform. And then that whisper quickly disappears. And it doesn't only disappear, but it's sort of turned on itself by political forces who, you'll see, I suspect, in the next several hours, people aggressively from the right sort of turning on the entire story and saying, well, this will be used, to try to forward gun control in Congress. And those forces will come out very powerfully. And they will, in fact, quell any political movement that might come out of a story like this. We've seen this over and over again after the Tucson shooting. And, there was talk of limiting the type of magazines that were used by the gunmen out there. So we'll hear some talk about that, but it will quickly be put down by the NRA, by the supporters of that, and frankly, by the folks who put the money into our political system that tends to cripple, at this point, political action. And it's not just on a story like this, but really on every story right now. It's incredibly frustrating for someone, like me. I've been, covering election integrity issues, and it seems that no matter how much evidence, how much information, how much you inform the public about what's really going on out there, journalism seems to have lost its ability to a certain extent to move the dial, to move the needle on public discussion.
Well, and we will talk more about this in the second half of the show, because mm-hmm. the angles you brought up are important, and we'll talk about how it might be spun in the coming weeks. And again, it was a midnight screening of the new Batman movie in Aurora, Colorado, a suburb of Denver. A gunman opened fire on the audience. 12 people have been confirmed dead. And we'll talk a little bit about the coverage of this later in the show. That is Brad. He blogs at thebradblog.com. He's a journalist and a radio broadcaster. And now I would like to welcome Michael Peel to the show. Michael is Middle East correspondent with the Financial Times, and he's joining us from Damascus, Syria. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Hi, good. Thank you for joining us. I'm glad we connected with you. Before we dive in and talk about Syria and how you're going to go about reporting from there, we always start off Friday on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Michael, what did you see this week that you thought was reported well?
Well, I've seen over the last couple of weeks some very vivid reports by Ruth Sherlock of Britain's Daily Telegraph, who's been in Syria, in northern Syria, reporting from the armed opposition side of the lines there, and she's really got to the heart very well of both the human story there and the political story there about who this movement, it's really very diverse movement, consists of.
And so when did you arrive in Damascus?
I arrived yesterday afternoon.
And what was that process like for you? Because last week we spoke with a journalist who was kicked out of Damascus, and she says it's incredibly difficult to get in.
Well, I got a visa and came here. I mean, the visa process the period of this uprising, it's been very difficult to get visas. It's been easier. So everyone has had a different experience.
And you just arrived. Can you give us an update on what's happening? I mean, so much has been happening in just the last few days. There was the bomb attack on Wednesday that killed three top Syrian officials. President Bashar Assad made his first TV state appearance last night, but many outlets are questioning the photo's authenticity. And then we've got tens of thousands of people, as high as 50,000 people, are fleeing to neighboring Lebanon and Jordan.
Well, it's been a very violent and dramatic day in Damascus. From just before the Friday lunchtime prayers, which are the center of the Islamic week, there were explosions going off in the central area of Medan and in areas further south where there's been a lot of clashes this week. Then there's been gunfire around the city, more explosions on the other side of the city, sort of smoke rising from behind the Qasyun mountain, which towers over the city. And a sounds of gunfire from other places, and even now into the evening, it's just getting dark now. In the last half hour, there've been a number of heavy explosions, and outside my window, I can see people in the street in a nearby government building who are watching this. And like everyone else in Damascus, if you're not in a conflict zone, you can hear it and you're aware of what's going on, and people are very anxious, obviously, about what's happening. And the reports you've been seeing of people fleeing are a reflection of that. And within the city, I've seen people who've been fleeing their areas in cars or buses. There's been very little traffic around, but some of the traffic that has been around has been buses, which have been piled full of people. Mm. Not all of them necessarily fleeing the country. Some might be going to other areas, other towns, or indeed other parts of the city, bolt holes where they have relatives, to sit it out as long as this goes on. But the point is that although this violence in one sense is localized and it's taking place in specific areas, not every area is under fire, it certainly feels like it's taking place almost everywhere, because you can hear the sounds of it and see the effects of it.
Michael Peel is joining us from Damascus. He's Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He'll be with us for about 10 or so more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about coverage of Syria, if you have questions about what's happening on the ground, now is a good time to call 866-798-8255. How are you making sense of all of the developments that we've been hearing in the media the past couple of days, and what questions do you have? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Michael, according to reports, Syrian rebels seized control of critical border crossings as tens of thousands of people flee. Who are these rebels specifically?
Well, this is the armed opposition movement which has sprung up in this uprising, which has been going on for more than 16 months since March last year. And I think it's generally accepted that initially this was a peaceful movement. There were peaceful protests in the south of the country, in the southern city of Daraa, after some children were arrested for scrawling anti-government graffiti. And indeed, these are not necessarily people who were looking for change of regime. They were protesting about this specific incident.
I think we lost Michael. Yep, that's Michael Peel. We connected with him in Damascus, but we knew that the phone lines would be a little spotty. So we will try to reconnect with him. Brad Friedman, I'm wondering, have you been following what's happening on the ground in Syria? There's been so many developments just over the past 3 days.
You know what? I have not been able to follow it as close as I like. And frankly, I don't think any of us have been able to follow it particularly closely because of so much of the media blackout out there. I had hoped, you know, to ask Michael if he had a sense of, you know, speaking of templates of coverage, this seems to be one of those stories that has a certain trajectory, has a certain, you know, ending that's not going to be good for the Assad regime. And the question is, you know, how long will it take, or is there any signs that the rebels are planning to back down? I get no sense of that. It just seems like it's a question of
of how long this will take, how many how many dead bodies we will see between now and the time there finally is regime change out in Syria.
Right. Well, that's the question on so many people's minds. And I just wanted to also mention that the journalist I spoke of earlier, Salma El-Wardani, she joined us last week, and she was kicked out of Damascus. And I think we've got Michael back. Michael, are you back with us? Okay, great. So we'll just see what happens. Hopefully we can keep you for about another 10 minutes or so. Again, we're speaking with Michael Peel in Damascus, and we might lose him. So let's try to get as much as we can. The big question, Michael, on everyone's mind is how long is this going to last? The bombing attack on Wednesday killed three top Syrian officials. This was a first. What is your read on what President Assad is going to do next?
I don't think not just anti-regime people, but the pro-regime people as well, that the government will strike back very hard at this world of authority. And certainly there seems to be evidence in some areas that that's already begun. There was in the Caribbean today where there was very extensive damage from what people said was shelling by the government yesterday, which has killed more than 30 people.
Michael, we're having a hard time with your line. Let's just see if we can get it to sound a little bit better. I'm just going to ask our listeners questions because the line is not so good. Harry in San Francisco wants to know, if the Assad regime does step down, who will take over?
Well, again, the question that nobody really knows the answer to. This is one of a huge number of uncertainties. When you talk to people in Damascus, nobody really can see where this is going, whatever their political views. It turned into a pitched conflict for the capital. And clearly the opposition is a very diverse set of interests. The range of useful access to army defenses. It's just impossible to say who would take over in the event of the regime collapsing. But of course, it's not a given that the regime is going to collapse.
You know, Michael, I'm so sorry. We cannot understand what you're saying. We're going to have to either try to call you back, or maybe we'll try to connect with you next Friday. We tried Michael on both his UK line and his cell phone in Damascus, and unfortunately, the lines just are not sounding good. So thank you for joining us. Sorry about that, Michael. He's a Middle East correspondent with the Financial Times, currently reporting from Damascus. And we will closely follow this and hopefully try to bring Michael on next week with a better line. And just to give you another update, the situation's becoming very tense. According to reports, tens of thousands of Syrians are fleeing Syria to go to neighboring Lebanon and Jordan. Last night, President Bashar Assad made his first state TV appearance about a lot of questions about where he was, because people haven't seen him for days. But many media outlets are now questioning the photo's authenticity. And then on Wednesday, there was a bomb attack that killed three top Syrian officials. This was a first. And many heads of state say that the next is that Assad has no choice but to back down. There was also an interview on NPR this morning. We will link to it. And a number of guests on that segment said that the U.S. is not providing aid to the rebels, but what they're trying to do is gather intelligence, figure out who's doing what, and who's giving aid to whom. So we will continue following this and possibly do a show on Syria in the coming weeks. I just want to thank Michael Peel for joining us. And we're going to switch gears now and talk about voter suppression, and also talk about media coverage of what happened in Colorado. And if you have any questions or comments about that, unfortunately, it was a horrific shooting in Colorado at midnight. It was at the screening of Batman in Aurora, Colorado, a suburb of Denver. 12 people have been confirmed dead. As far as officials know, it was one man, a 24-year-old white American, who carried out this shooting. And we were talking with Brad Friedman earlier just about how the media covers these horrific events. Brad is a journalist and radio broadcaster. He blogs at thebradblog.com. And Brad, why don't we just finish with this thought before we talk about voter suppression? Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of the formulaic coverage here, in fact, on NPR this morning, a number of the analysts were saying that gun control has not been an issue in this election, and they don't think that it will be, because frankly, a lot of President Obama's supporters thought he was going to do more on gun control, but the last report card coming from the Brady campaign gave him an F on gun control.
Yeah, and deservedly so. I mean, he has he's expanded gun rights. He has done, you know, the opposite of what the NRA has been out there pretending that he is doing. He expanded gun rights when he came into office. He hasn't said otherwise a word about it, and that's despite, you know, a lot of these shootings that we have seen over the last year or two or three, even down in Tucson. And you would think an opportunity like what happened down in Tucson for taking action would be acted on by a Democratic administration when, you know, a Democratic congresswoman has been, almost murdered down there. But in fact, nothing has happened. Nothing has come about. And I think it speaks to the crippling control that these advocate groups now have on our entire, I want to say political system, but also on our entire media system overall. And, so we tend to cover these events when they happen. We go around the clock with them for 24 hours, 48 hours. We'll probably, pick up a few of the funerals that will occur in the next few days. And then we'll be back to the same silly nonsense that seems to, suffice for political coverage in this country, unfortunately.
Well, and I posted on our Facebook page this morning, how should the media cover this issue? And we got a comment from Sean who says, education underfunded, prisons overpopulated, banks bailed out, college grads in debt, partisan politics. Everyone will scratch their collective heads thinking, how could this happen? He says this is not only a sad day for everyone involved in Colorado, it's a sad day for civility and what's left of it. And I'd love to get listeners in on this. How do you think these sorts of horrific shootings should be covered? What questions should the media be asking? Because they're often thought of as isolated events, and then we go on to the next one. So what questions do you think reporters should be asking? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on that, Brad, and just the larger questions that this raises?
Well, it's interesting because coverage in the media of any of these stories right now, what we tend to see is coverage that is driven by politicians and advocates, for or against any particular issue. We don't see a lot of reporting, and I can sort of speak to this firsthand in a lot of the things that we cover at BradBlog, having to do with elections and election integrity and so forth. I cover those issues because I think they are important. I cover those important developments. It's not necessarily based on what the politicians want to talk about from any party. Hmm. It's not necessarily based on what advocates for or against election reform want to talk about. It's a matter of following the news, and I guess that's kind of old school these days, but that's what we see. We see the opposite of that. We see people, if Barack Obama, or Mitt Romney come out, they have a message each day, and that becomes the coverage of that day's media, whatever Obama and Romney essentially want to talk about. And what it means is those are the popular stories, those are the sites that that get the web traffic, but the things that actually matter to us as a society tend to get ignored, tend to fly way under the radar. So, the things that I cover, that we cover at BradBlog.com, may not be the most popular things, but we don't wait until a few weeks, a few months before an election to start talking about election integrity, because that's not when things change. Things change in regard to election integrity, years before an election. You can't, go in there and change the voting system now. And I think the failing of the media is to chase those profits, to chase that traffic on the web, instead of chasing what is actually news.
Well, I'd love to hear listeners on these issues. 866-798-8255. We are talking about coverage of the horrific shootings in Colorado. We will also talk about coverage of voter ID laws. 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
If you're on Facebook, becoming a fan of KALW is an easy way to spread the word about the programming that you value right here on Local Public Radio. It's easy. Just click the Facebook link on the front page of our website, kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our new newsletter to find out what's coming up on Monday. We'll talk about why photojournalism still matters. Speaking of news coverage, we'll speak with Ken Cobra about his new documentary, Deadline Every Second, which follows 12 of the 12 top Associated Press photojournalists in 8 countries as they cover everything from war and political clashes to the financial markets and natural disasters. So what insights do you get from photographs, and what's the last news photo that you remember? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org, and be sure to like us on Facebook. We are now ramping up our Your Call presence there, including posting a lot of the articles that we talk about on a regular basis. Today we are talking about media coverage, and we are joined by Brad Friedman. He's a journalist and radio broadcaster. He blogs at thebradblog.com, and we're going to speak with Brad about voter suppression, and hopefully we'll be joined by Brenton Mock soon. He covers voter ID laws with Color Lines, and unfortunately Brenton is stuck in a horrible storm, some bizarre storm that just happened in New Orleans. Doesn't usually happen this time of the year, but he's stuck in a restaurant, so we'll be joining with Brenton shortly. And I just wanted to finish this thought, Brad, on how the media are covering this horrific shooting in Colorado. The Brady campaign came out with a press release saying that President Obama signed legislation letting people carry concealed weapons in national parks and checked luggage on Amtrak trains, adopted the gun lobby's rhetoric about, quote, enforcing the laws on the books, muzzled cabinet members who expressed any support for stronger gun laws, and failed to appoint permanent leadership at the agency that polices the gun industry. Yet we don't really hear about this much in the media.
Not only do we not hear about this much, but if you ask the people of this country, you know, what Barack Obama's position is on gun control, they'll probably, and I don't have the statistics here to cite this, so please forgive me, but, you know, I suspect that there is a huge portion of the populace, if not the majority of the populace, who believes that, you know, Barack Obama wants to take your guns away.
Right.
How did that happen? What is the failing of the media that we could have so many people in this country so desperately disinformed? I'm not even going to say misinformed, disinformed, purposely given inaccurate information. How does that happen in a country like ours in 2012? I mean, this is a tremendous failing, and it is not just of the media, but I believe that it's an indictment of the entire system. And frankly, so many of the problems that we're looking at in this country today follow this template, are because the media, for whatever reason, has a very difficult time getting out the truth to our nation. And it's incredibly frustrating, but more importantly, it is incredibly crippling to this nation. And and at the core of so many of the messes we find ourselves quagmired in right now.
Well, Ladd Everett, Director of Communications for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, just tweeted, 13 years since Columbine and our legislators have done almost nothing to prevent homicidal maniacs from gaining easy access to guns. He wrote, Barack Obama, condolences are not enough. What are you going to do about guns? So this is going to play out in the coming weeks, and it'll be interesting to find out if reporters do ask Mitt Romney and Barack Obama on the campaign trail about gun control.
And you know what? And we will see if they do. There may be a few questions here and there, obviously, over the next few days. But, you know, all of these problems, at least the ones I'm referencing, and I believe the ones that are crippling our nation, you know, come back to money in politics. No one wants to take on the NRA on right or left, period, because these are the guys who fund their campaigns or fund the opponents of their campaigns. It is all about money in politics. That is the elephant in the room. That has been the elephant in the room. And that elephant is growing huger and huger, unfortunately, by the day.
A statement from the group Coalition to Stop Gun Violence reports that the shooter, 24-year-old James Holmes, wore body armor and was armed with two Glock handguns, a tactical shotgun, and an AR-15-style assault rifle. He also released some type of chemical gas into the theater. 12 fatalities have been reported so far, with 38 moviegoers injured, including 16 critically. And if you'd like to weigh in on the coverage of this, I'd love to hear your thoughts about what you think so far and how you think these horrific events should be covered. What questions should we be asking? And if we do a show on gun control, we've been actually wanting to do a show about a documentary about one of the men who survived the horrific tragedy in Virginia, called Living for 32. What do you think we can add to the conversation? What questions should we be asking? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And then, as always, if there was a story you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, we would love to hear from you. And we are going to switch gears and talk about voter suppression and coverage of the voter ID laws. And if you have anything to add about that, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave a comment at Your Call Radio so others can see it. And you can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about what's happening with voter suppression laws, Brad. A new report just came out from the Brennan Center for Justice. Mm-hmm. New laws in 10 states requiring voters to show photo ID will make it more difficult for millions of Americans to cast ballots and likely drive down turnout among minorities, the poor, and the elderly. This is a huge study that just came out. We're talking about Alabama, Georgia, Indiana, Kansas, Mississippi, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Wisconsin. What do you think of the media coverage so far in looking at what voter ID laws actually mean?
Overall, I think it has been horrible. We have been covering this at bradblog.com going on a decade now. None of these things that are happening are a surprise. You know, these are blatant attempts to keep people from being able to cast their legal vote, to keep legal voters from being able to cast their legal vote. And I have to say, even in our discussion here, your reference to voter ID, this is a failing of Democrats. This is a failing of opponents polling place photo ID restrictions. This is not about voter ID. The bad guys would like us, to have a discussion about voter ID because, hey, identifying yourself at the polling place, a voter offering ID sounds perfectly reasonable. Well, the fact is, most of the country, most of the states across the nation already require voter ID. They have for many years. It's not really a problem because they allow for a broad range of identification from not just driver's license and state-issued photo ID, but also bank statements, tax returns, check stubs, all sorts of things that would identify the voter. The problem here is this very, very narrowly tailored polling place photo ID restriction, state-issued photo ID, photo ID that the Republican legislatures that are passing these laws know damn well that tens, if not hundreds of thousands of voters, legal voters, do not have in their states, in the states where these things are passed. We just saw a report last week that some 750,000 eligible voters in the state of Pennsylvania do not have the type of photo ID that will be required under the new Republican law that has been passed. So what we've seen is a lot of reports going for months and years now, you know, sort of doing this one side says this, the other side says that nonsense, which is in this case, Republican supporters of voter ID bills feel it's necessary to prevent voter fraud. Democrats believe that it is a matter of voter suppression. And then they sort of leave the reader to decide who's got the best argument for that. But they don't give us the facts. And it takes groups like the Brennan Center to come forward and say, these are the facts. We are talking about millions of Americans who could be disenfranchised under these laws. And at the same time, the advocates for these laws are able to produce not a single example of a case of voter fraud at the polling place that would be deterred by these laws, because in fact the only type of fraud that can be deterred possibly by these laws is voter impersonation at the polling place, and that is extraordinarily rare in this country, period.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up voter suppression, because it seems like there's some hesitation on the part of the media in using that term to cover these laws. For example, the New York Times recently ran a story about an elderly African-American woman whose ID was stolen, and because of complications, she wasn't able to get another ID. So she's now suing the state for denying her the right to vote. And the New York Times said, whether true or not, the focus on what Democrats call, quote, voter suppression is accelerating as the November 6th election looms.
Right.
So they're only using the term voter suppression in the context of what Democrats are calling it.
What Democrats call it. This would be the equivalent of, you know, having a weather report which says, Republicans say it's raining outside. Meanwhile, Democrats say it's sunny. Who knows who's telling the truth? Well, we can all go to the window and see that it is sunny outside. So, you know, if the facts are on one side of the argument, report the facts. We don't have to this phony balance now, and I say phony balance that stretches across the media is absolutely crippling, and we see it certainly in this fight over photo ID restrictions, which is the most alarming assault on voting rights since the Jim Crow era. Period.
And altogether, 33 states have passed laws requiring identification. According to this new Brennan Center study, one quarter of African Americans, 16% of Hispanics, and 18% of Americans over 65 do not have the type of ID that these new laws require. How many of these laws are now in the court system other than Texas?
Boy, it's hard to keep track because it keeps moving, and we have both challenges at the federal level by the Department of Justice in only a couple of states. And by the way, let me note that the Department of Justice is doing a terrible job of defending the right to vote in this country under the Voting Rights Act. So we've got some cases in South Carolina and in Texas. Where these laws are being challenged by the Department of Justice, down in Florida, where it's not photo ID restrictions, but a voter purge that is going on, that the media has been horribly misreporting on what's actually going on down there, and then you've got state-level challenges where the ACLU and the League of Women Voters who are groups like that who are bringing challenges to these laws at the state level.
And can you just give us a brief synopsis of what's happening in Florida?
Yeah, it's amazing what's happening in Florida. Governor Rick Scott, the Republican governor who came in, the Tea Party governor who came in the 2010 wave, essentially came to office and said, hey, how can we purge what we believe to be non-citizens from the voting rolls? Now, he didn't really have any evidence that there were non-citizens on the voting rolls. So this appears to be yet another assault on voters who tend to vote for Democrats. But he put together a list of 182,000 registered voters who he said were, quote, potential non-citizens. He went. He asked for his previous Secretary of State, his previous Republican Secretary of State, Kurt Browning, to start purging these people from the list. And Kurt Browning, who had been an election official for some 30 years, said, you know, no, I'm not going to do that, because the fact is we don't know whether these people are non-citizens or not. In February of this year, Kurt Browning finally resigned, and Rick Scott's hand-picked successor, Ken Detzner, came into office, and then they began this purge. And what we found was many of these people who they claimed to be non-citizens actually were citizens. You know, for example, 91-year-old Bill Internicola, who was born in Brooklyn. He won a Bronze Star in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. He was one of the folks who was sent a note by the supervisor of elections in his county, telling him that if he did not request an administrative hearing in 30 days where he would come and prove his citizenship, he would be removed from the rolls. So all of these people have been presumed guilty until they can show up and prove themselves innocent. And the most extraordinary point of this story is that Rick Scott and Ken Detzner, the Secretary of State, have been running around telling people that, well, our list would have been more accurate had the federal government, had the Barack Obama administration's Department of Homeland Security allowed us to use this federal immigration database. But they've been blocking us, and you know, we think it's because they want non-citizens to vote for them this November. But the fact is, at bradblog.com, we did public records requests, and we looked at emails going back and forth between the state of Florida and the Department of Homeland Security. And as early as October of last year, you've got the state of Florida admitting to the federal government that they simply do not have the information needed to access this federal immigration database, because they have to have certain unique identifiers, naturalization numbers, alien registration numbers, and so forth, that the state of Florida simply doesn't have. Florida admitted to this. They were trying to find a workaround. But in the meantime, Governor Rick Scott has been coming out in the media claiming that the federal government is blocking us. Barack Obama is refusing to let us have access to this database. That is a blatant lie. And it should be reported as such, and since it's certainly on record, since we have certainly published the emails at the Brad blog, there is no excuse that the media continue to run around and you know, report this as, you know, Governor Rick Scott says Barack Obama is blocking him. That is absolute, complete, and utter nonsense.
And that is Brad Friedman. He's a journalist and radio broadcaster. He blogs at the Brad blog. And we have a number of calls on the shootings, which we'll take in just a minute. So please hold tight. I just want to take one call about IDs before we go back to media coverage of what happened in Colorado. Let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hey, hi, Rose and your guests. I'm glad I followed Brad there on this topic. There's a famous old joke about a little kid that is at the Mexican border, and he crosses the border every day with a wagon load of sand. And for years, they try to figure out what he's smuggling in this sand. There's no reason to haul sand across the border. Turns out he's smuggling wagons. So what the with this ID issue, I hope Brad can get into Choice Point specifically, but I'm hearing now that the companies that are producing IDs, the states are now privatizing the manufacturing of IDs. So it goes into this issue about whether or not organized crime can be involved in manufacturing the IDs itself, which then gives organized crime the ability to not only control who's a citizen, but also whether or not they can create a whole security apparatus with those fake IDs.
Where are you reading about this?
Well, that's actually come up in a number of different, if I remember right, Colorado had gotten into it during Arnold. There was discussion of whether or not the state's IDs would be manufactured by a privatized company.
Huh.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. Brad, do you know much about this?
You know, I don't. It's sort of an interesting sidebar to this discussion. It would not
you know, surprised me at all. Similarly to the way we, you know, we saw the privatization of prisons sort of go along with the minimum sentencing laws in this country, it wouldn't surprise me at all. There's certainly going to be a huge market in many of these states where they're passing these laws. You know, they claim that you can have a free ID if, as a, you know, 91-year-old World War II veteran who doesn't drive, who doesn't have the driver's license, if you can somehow make your way to a Department of Motor Vehicles, if you can find your birth certificate, if not, you can pay for your birth certificate, bring it in and get one of these so-called free IDs after you've spent untold number of dollars, untold amount of time trying to get them. So there is this huge opening, indeed, for a private company, I suspect, to step in and say, "Oh yeah, we'll take care of your producing those free IDs for you at such and such a cost." But I hadn't heard anything specifically about that happening, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, I just did a search. There's some reporting by Wired, for example, about national IDs being privatized, driver's licenses being privatized. So yeah, we'll have to look into this. And thank you so much for the call, David.
But I should say, I don't think that in this case, I guess that would be a side benefit for the people who are pushing this this sort of legislation. It is clear that the Republican attempt to impose polling place photo ID restrictions is clearly about keeping legal Democratic-leaning voters from voting. Mm-hmm. Period.
Well, again, according to this new report that the Brennan Center just put out, new laws in 10 states will make it more difficult for, we're talking about millions of people here, mostly minorities, the poor, and the elderly.
And let me, you know, speak to one other point, because this is so misreported in the media. So many people hear this story, and they say, well, you know, it makes sense. You need an ID to buy a beer. You need, an ID to get on a plane. Why not an ID to vote? And let me just speak to that very quickly. One, buying beer and getting on a plane are privileges. They are not rights. Voting is a right, so it is treated differently. Secondly, I have flown on planes, I have bought beers, and I cannot remember the last time I was forced to give an ID. I haven't been, maybe because I'm too old, I haven't been asked to show an ID when I buy a beer. And the fact of the matter is, if you do not have a photo ID and you want to get on a plane, you will be allowed to get on that plane. You may have to go through some extra security procedures, but the commercial airlines are smart enough to know that they don't wish to turn away 25 million potential customers in this country who do not have photo ID. So there's, once again, a lot of misinformation and disinformation that is being placed out there in order to trick our populace into believing we need to have photo ID restrictions at the polling place.
Well, we will definitely continue to cover this and do a show about it. I just wanted to get to a couple. We have a number of emails about the shooting. Tara on our Facebook page says, I find it interesting that when a white gunman kills, it's a medical, legal, and social issue. When a person of color kills, it tends to be seen as a moral and ethical issue. Judith writes in, regarding the formulaic coverage of these types of mass shootings, I don't understand why is a white person who terrorizes a community never considered a terrorist? Somehow that label seems to be saved only for the Islamic other. Eugene says that everything you're talking about are the result of neoliberal policies. Many in this country refuse to understand the consequences of a corporate state with profit as the driving force. And Alan writes in and says, we should also talk about the fact that earlier this week, Rush Limbaugh went on a rant about the Batman character's name being Bane, as in Bane Capital, as if there's a connection to Mitt Romney. I hope you'll look into this. Well, we definitely don't want to stretch this, but that is kind of interesting to look at just all the different comments that have been coming out. But specifically, we want to talk about how this is being covered. And let's hear from Hayden in San Francisco. Hi, Hayden.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
But I just wanted to say, actually, one comment about the Bane Capital. I believe the character Bane was actually created before the Bane Capital, but I'm not sure that.
And for people, I saw the movie actually on Thursday. Bane is sort of the villain in the movie, just to let people know.
And the character was developed, I think, in 1993.
Okay.
All right. And so what are your thoughts, Hayden, on the coverage?
I've heard a couple stories, and it seems like they're going straight to gun laws And I know that's a maybe an easier issue to tackle and deal with, but I feel like the motives and maybe just the behavior of this individual should be really looked at and tried to, I don't know, figure out like what we could do to stop. You know, obviously, I think I heard a comment about keeping how gun laws can enable homicidal people, you know, to get these guns, but what about the homicidal people? I think they're really the problem, it seems like.
Well, thank you. And that comment, again, came from the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. And we'll get a response in just a minute. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
I hope I can touch on three subjects really quickly. One is I just learned about this shooting in Colorado this morning, which is appalling. But I think people need to keep in mind, and I don't mean to demean the issue. It's a horrific incident. But you got to keep in mind that America is a violent country. There's between 10 and 20,000 murders mm-hmm. every year in this country. So, I mean, that's one thing that people need to keep in the forefront of their mind. This kind of thing just gets spectacular coverage for whatever reason. Anyway, that's one thing. The other thing is on Syria, and once again, not to demean the issue in Syria, because I think it's a serious issue and has tremendous implications worldwide. But as I was pointed out the other day when I was listening to another program, in Mexico in the last, I believe it is a decade, maybe less, there have been between 50 and 60,000 murders in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I mean, you know, just put that in sort of perspective. And lastly, on the voting, you know, I guess people will wake up someday and realize, you know, do we really have a democracy? I mean, from the time that Bush stole the election in 2000 until now, this is 12 years. This has been going on since Jim Crow. I mean, they're going to do anything they can to try and rig the elections to benefit people who have wealth and power.
Well, thank you. And just one small example, Brad, you've got this story about California officials pleading guilty to absentee election fraud. And we only have a minute left, but can you just give us a quick synopsis of this? This is important.
Yeah. Indeed, as we talked about, voter fraud is incredibly rare in this country. The voters are, by and large, doing fine. Leave them alone. Where voter fraud does occur, it tends to be by absentee voting. And the fact of the matter is that these polling place photo ID restrictions we've been talking about have nothing to do with absentee voting. In this case in California, it wasn't even the voter fraud via absentee ballot. It was, once again, as usual, the greatest threat to elections, insider officials. And you had the mayor and the city manager out there in Cudahy, California, who were able to intercept incoming absentee ballots, open them up, and forward on the ones that they liked the way that the voters had voted, and essentially destroy the absentee ballots that they didn't like the way that they voted.
And we should say they have agreed to plead guilty to federal charges of bribery and extortion.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things I've warned about. You have to vote by mail, don't do it.
It's fascinating because a lot of us think that's the way we should do it to avoid this. But you say this is why we shouldn't do absentee voting.
You're allowed to vote on a paper ballot. Yeah, you're allowed to vote on a paper ballot on election day.
We'll definitely continue to cover this. And Hayden, we will also explore your question in a later show. Brad Friedman is a journalist and broadcaster. You can find his reports bradblog.com. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you, Rose.
And thank you for listening. Thanks for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar, and here's what's coming up on Monday. Why does photojournalism still matter? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Ken Cobra about his new documentary, Deadline Every Second. The film follows 12 top AP photojournalists in 8 countries as they cover war, political clashes, financial markets, and natural disasters. Cobra says the film will change how you look at news images. So what insights do you get from a photo, and what's the last news photo you remember? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.